Prisons are something that is a very major part of our society, even though we don't often see them. We have approximately a million people behind bars in this country in some form or another, either prisons, jails, detention centers, other incarceration places. That's a lot of people. And the numbers are expected to double in the next 10 years. That will be 2 million people. Our rate of incarceration in this country is about twice that of most industrialized nations. And if this doubling occurs, it will be four or five times most industrialized nations. So we have a lot of people in prison, and we're giving longer and longer sentences. Unfortunately, people who are in prison don't reflect our population very well either. African Americans, for example, are 11% of our population in the country, but in the 1990 census, it's expected that 50% of the prison population will be African Americans. One in four African American males will be incarcerated sometime during their life. One in 3.5 American Indian males will be incarcerated. Hispanics are imprisoned at twice the rate of their proportion of the population, and poor people as well are vastly overrepresented in our prisons. So we're doing something in our prisons that, with people who are on the margins of our society. The ACLU in a study found that non-whites receive sentences 30% more severe than whites. People of color are also 25% less likely than whites to receive early parole. So we have a situation that isn't very pretty. We also have, I don't know how many people realize this, we have a constitution in these United States that still allows for slavery. I don't know if you know about that. The 13th Amendment of the Constitution specifically allows slavery, quote, as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, unquote. And we have people from the margins put into our prisons and doing, in a sense, a kind of forced labor. Whether they're paid or not, it doesn't matter, because slavery is allowed in our Constitution if you've been convicted of a crime. Biblically, if we look at it, there is no justification, really, for the use of prisons as a way of dealing with crime. Prisons are never suggested as a way of dealing with the horror of crime. Crime is terrible, and there are many victims who suffer a great deal, but the Bible never proposes, Old Testament or New, that prisons are the remedy for crime. In fact, in every case of imprisonment and confinement we find in the Bible, God is always on the side of the imprisoned. We also have a lot of scripture passages that tell us things like Psalm 146, the Lord sets prisoners free. Psalm 102, our God is the God who hears the groans of prisoners and releases those condemned to death. In Luke 4, Jesus tells us that his mission and the mission for all his followers is to break every chain and release every captive. In Matthew 25, Jesus tells us that it's he who we are visiting when we visit those in prison. And we're told that when we help the hungry, we're helping him. When we help the naked, or clothe the naked, we're clothing him. When we give drink to the thirsty, we're giving drink to him. The clear implication in that passage in Matthew 25 is that all those things are things that are positions in which people should not find themselves. We should not find ourselves hungry or thirsty or naked or in prison. All four of those are things that God does not want to see anyone in those positions. My position then is that prisons are barbaric. They're totally ineffective, and in fact, most of those who studied it would say that they're actually counterproductive. They don't reduce crime, they increase crime, and they're also absolutely contrary to what Scripture repeatedly tells us that God is about. So my position is that as Christians, we have to start forcibly and persuasively speaking out for the abolition of prisons because they are contrary to God's way, and we need to find new ways to deal with crime.
Thank you.
My set?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Prison Fellowship Ministries is involved primarily with ministry to prisoners, ex-prisoners, and their families, but we don't, in effect, do it directly. We assist the church because our belief is that, you know, parachurch organizations die, someday prison fellowship is going to be gone, but the church is going to be here until the second coming of Jesus Christ. And so that's where we work with training, supervision, and helping reach prisoners. And it's there's a lot of failures to this business, but there are successes as well. And we really have a strong feeling about people who sell drugs. I got a friend named Hank Steves in Minneapolis who was selling drugs. He had an antique furniture business, and that was the front with organized crime for selling drugs. And he was one time shot when he was resisting arrest, right through the aorta here, but by a miraculous way he stayed alive. He went to prison three times. The last time he was in Stillwater Prison, it was about 12 years ago when he got out. He had gone on methadone. He said, usually you take 4 units of methadone and get off heroin. And he was on 250 units of methadone. And so he went back on heroin again to get off his methadone. And he was able to get enough because he was a guy who was in charge of selling it. He was the inmate who was selling heroin in the prison. His partner came to know Jesus Christ. And he couldn't understand this. His partner talked with him. And then I think it was Joan Conrad, a Lutheran pastor in Minnesota, that came and led him to Christ. And he went off cold turkey without any physical effects. He'd gone off cold turkey a couple times before and knew the excruciating pain. And this was a miraculous thing that happened to him. I met a guy, Larry Grimes, here in the state of Washington, the same way. The only two people I ever heard of going off like that. Hank Steves now heads up Hidden Ranch, halfway house for women in Minnesota. And here's a miraculous thing that happened with a person who was ministered to in prison, and he is now one of our instructors as well in prison seminars. Now when I tell that, and I run across with people who are free in Christ in prison, and you say, well, that was good. Hank Steve met Christ there, he got off heroin, now he's leading a straight life and doing a wonderful thing. But anything that I see of prison, I think is a failure. Now, it isn't just my view. I was in talking to Mike Quinlan, who's the director of federal prisons, and they just passed that legislation, the tough legislation on drug crimes in the Congress. And I asked them, said, how much do you expect that the prison population is going to increase? And he figured in 5 years the federal prison population would be double, and more than half of them would be in there on drug crimes. And then he did like this. He said, but the thing is that it doesn't work. It doesn't work. And we talk a little bit more. Prison does not work. I was in Anoka County outside of Minneapolis to visit their new jail, state-of-the-art jail. Man alive, this is as good as our maximum security state-of-the-art prison in Minnesota. And the sheriff, you know, was in charge of the jail. And it's an inhuman situation. You know, when you go through a usual jail, you can walk, if they elect you, walk down there. And if you know anybody, you can talk to them through the bars. You walk down through that one, there's glass. There are no bars, there's glass. You can't talk to them in there. You see them like fish in a bowl in there. And it's inhuman. And in Anoka, the chaplain can't walk amongst them. They send word over the loudspeaker to the chaplain's office, and you want to come to them, you can come to them. You can't reach out to people there. And when I'd done that, I went to the sheriff's office and see him. And I said, well, what do you think? And he put his head down. And he said, all I can say, we're warehousing too many people. I was out in Montana, and two wardens were there at a prison fellowship meeting that we had. And both of them said the same thing. It doesn't work. When are we going to come into this century? At least we ought to do some things like, you know, you have electronic surveillance and they can live in their home. What is it now? You take them away from any livelihood, cost $17,000 to $20,000 at least to keep them there, and their family probably goes on welfare. I mean, it's an enormous cost to the taxpayers if you just want to look at the economic side of it. And they as well said there was no rehabilitation there. There are some places that are attempting rehabilitation. We continue to do so in Minnesota. If you don't believe the figures that Mark said is going to double at the rate we're going to go by 2000, just bear in mind, and he used the figure that there's 263 people in prison now per 100,000. District of Columbia, there are already double that. There are 560 people in prison per 100,000 in Washington, D.C. And they send them to Lorton Penitentiary outside of Washington, D.C. People in center cities are more dependent on public transportation. Those who love them, who can reach out to them, have little opportunity to get to Lorton Penitentiary. The only people who can get there are good-hearted suburban people. But the good-hearted suburban people are mostly white. In fact, everybody in Washington, D.C. prisons are black. And we all like our own people. And they have a difficult time, the blacks have a difficult time. I haven't gotten to using the new term Afro-American yet, and no black or Afro-American has kicked me in the shins yet for using that. So I'll come around pretty quick, Mark, on that. But anyway, getting on to that. If there was any hope that it would work, it'd be all right. But I just want to bear you also to bear in mind that prisons are only 200 years old. They started by the Quakers in 1790 in Philadelphia. And they felt that the best way to solve our problem is to put a person in isolation, give them a Bible, and let them be penitent for a period of time. And that way they'd be away from their immoral friends. And that's what we call penitentiaries. It was named after what the Quakers said, so you could be penitent. And it didn't work there either. Most of them went mad. But that didn't stop us from all this time putting hard work and all kinds of things, and now medical and psychological treatment. What Mark suggested, we ought to let everybody out of prison, isn't going to happen, as you all know. It's sort of for us to look at this worthless thing that's going on. But enormous cost of us, terrible cost. When you talk about 17 to 20,000, that doesn't cost include the cost of construction. And then the political part of it, a lot of people say we're going to quit when the economics gets to us. We can't afford it anymore. It's breaking some states. I was just down in Georgia. They're going to build 10 new prisons. They already got 28 state prisons, and they've got 24 county prisons that they got state prisons in. They're going to build 10 more. And those of you in the state of Washington, I just talked to the Supreme Court judge this last week, you're going to build 6 new prisons here. I mean, one of the best states that we have. You're going to build 6 of them, but you can't find anybody who wants them in their community. And that's what they're trying to find. But once you get them in the community, the people will want them to continue there because they want the economy to keep going, so people can keep their jobs. They aren't automatically going to go and leave. Now, there are also some states where there's more hopeful. And North Dakota's got the lowest per capita. There's only 50 per 100,000 in North Dakota. And you like long sentences and tough jails? I mean, in North Dakota prison, I went in there, usually you gotta go practically through a total search of yourself before you go in. I went to North Dakota's prison in Bismarck, and I walked in the front door and I expected to sign in with somebody. I was with a volunteer. We walked up to the metal doors and they slid open and I walked in. I had maybe a sign in side here. And then, you know, there's always two doors. So the next one opened up, I walked through there, we went to the Bible study. And I never signed in or anything. And when I got in there, a guy named Paul Wilson from Minnesota was in prison there, and we visited after the Bible study. It was time to go. We kept visiting, and we came to the steel doors, and Paul stayed with me. And I figured, well, he's got turned back now, but the doors open, he walked with me. I figured, well, he'll just go into this inner part of it to see what it feels like, and he'll turn back before the next one. That one opened up, he went with me there, too. So I walked across the front part, which is about as long as this, to the front door, and he walked out the door with me, too. When I got to the car, I said, Paul, what are you doing here? And he said, oh, I work over at the dairy barn. I'm going down there and milk the cows now. And when I was about to go, another fellow drove up in a laundry truck. And the volunteer I was with, I said, come on over, meet this guy. So I did there. And I saw by the tag, he was an inmate. And I said, he is an inmate, isn't he? And he said, yeah. And I said, what's he doing? He said, well, the prison has a laundry that provides services for a number of towns around here, and he's got a laundry route around. I said, well, there's nobody with him. And he said, no, he goes out there alone, but he's a lifer, so he doesn't, he really gets to know all the people. He's going to be here for a long time. Well, you know, at least they got a little humanity to that prison, but when you want to be tough, that doesn't solve it at all. And we're second, by the way, in Minnesota. We're only 60 of them. You ought to be done now. But okay, I'll be quit. I'll quit now. And give you some of the things I hadn't told you before.
Okay, great.
I love telling stories.
I know. okay, let's hear first from Audrey here.
Oh dear.
Looking from the other side. And I know, yeah. And I want to say in advance, thank you to both of these women for sharing this, because this is, you know, obviously personal stories here, and it's difficult to risk that. So
yeah, we're listening to, from their point of view, saying, let everybody out. And I don't know what the right way is or that, but my story really is one of, I guess, small business crime. We lost, my daughter and I lost $20,000 in our business when we sold it. Other people lost more than that. We owned a small travel agency in the cities, and we worked very hard. We didn't make a lot of money, and we sold it, and we sold it to a couple. The lady was experienced, and they got a loan from the SBA, small business loan, to buy our agency, and they paid down, and except for $20,000, and we sold it to them, you know, for the other, and then we took a note for the $20,000. They did not pay the $20,000, so we had to go to court. We get a judgment against them, but in the meantime, they had. SBA had also found out that their loan was fraudulent, that they did not do anything truthfully as far as the as getting their loan. So the SBA went after them also. And at that point, they left town. They took their clients' money, people that had been saving for trips. They took that with them. They also took airline ticket stock, which is a federal offense, and skip town. So the marshals went after them, brought them back to town, and while they were awaiting trial, the husband committed suicide. And Pat, the wife, stood trial, and the judge gave her 2 years and said then she had restitution at this point when she get out of jail. She served 6 months and is out at this point. And the judge's saying that as far as the restitution would go, the people, the clients that had lost their money, they would get the money first, then the SBA, and then everybody else. So we are everybody else. But I don't know, you know, 6 months, people, she stole from her clients, she stole from the government, she stole from us, and a life is lost unnecessarily. And I don't know, I mean, Barb asked me to say, you know, to say what my feelings were on this, and 6 months is nothing for what she did, because, you know, a life and all these things should not have happened. But then I thought also, what if she had 10 years? It still wouldn't have made any difference, because these things still happened. So I don't have an answer.
Dorothy?
My story began, actually, when I realized, when Barb asked me to, or mentioned it, my story actually began exactly 18 years ago today. So it's sort of an anniversary, I suppose. I had been hired for a second year to work at an Episcopal church camp over on the other side of the mountains from here, and was with a friend exploring some of the trails and lakes prior to the opening of camp, and was in sort of known territory, but not particularly, since we never did find the lake that we were looking for. I'm sure some of you experienced that before. And we're on our way home, and had met several people on the trail, and the way trail walkers do, said hello, stopped on a couple of occasions and spoke. And one particular person we had stopped at had made a little camp, and so we talked for a few minutes, and then we went on. And by the time we had reached our car, which was just parked up a dirt road, really, this same person had come around, and by some other trail, I guess, and he stopped us and pulled a gun, and we were taken down the trail and off the road, and there I was raped, and I was obviously very much afraid, and I had a sense that this person really was going to finish us off. And I turned to my friend at one point somewhere along the way, and I said, what do we do now? And quietly, and she said, pray. And being an Episcopalian, I wasn't really accustomed to that. We weren't too good at that. I've since learned a few things, and so I tried a little of that, and I spoke to him and tried to tell him that I forgave him, that God loved him, and that, you know, if he would only let us free, we would not tell anybody, and so on. And I really, in many ways, from the bottom of my heart, I forgave him, and I never really have had any kind of emotional difficulties. I really believe in many ways I think I did. But for whatever reason, he did let us go, and we quietly got in the car and drove away. And then there was the problem mentally and psychologically of what do we do now, which lots of victims of crimes go through. And I was wrestling right away with the promise that I had made him, which was that I wouldn't tell anybody. And we sort of, in a daze, drove back and went up into the camp, and fortuitously, the priest who oversees the area was visiting and was walking around. He was alone, so we told him. And he sort of snapped us out of it and said, you have to tell the authorities. So from there we went to the police, back up to the site, down to the hospital, and the rest of the things that one does when that happens. The trial, I should back up. The next day, this man walked out on the road, Highway 2, and tried to hitchhike out and was picked up. So he was taken down to Everett, which is a small town north of Seattle, since that's the county seat, and was put in prison. And I continued to do my job as a camp counselor that summer and read the newspapers and didn't see my name, fortunately, but read all about this thing because it was big news for the area. And lo and behold, it became apparent that he had been involved in other crimes as well, including an unsolved sniping case in which a person had been shot and killed, and another person, this was from the highway in the area. His former wife or whatever had ratted on him, I guess. So it became a much bigger affair, and I realized at that point how lucky I was to be alive, because we indeed probably would have been finished off. The trial was at the end of the summer. He was convicted. It was the first rape case ever convicted in the state, in the Snohomish County. Since then, I'm sure there's been more. He also later on was convicted of the murders that he had committed. And he received numerous life sentences, 13 or something for just our case, and then another bunch. And he was pretty much destined to spend the rest of his life in prison. I heard that he was kind of nutty. We asked his defending attorney, we were very thankful and grateful to all the people that helped us, including his own attorney who we visited, and he told us a little bit about the person, and that the man was a young man, 25 or so years old, had been in and out of prison most of his life since about the age of 12, had been probably a child of child abuse, was very bright, and was a beautiful artist. We even saw some of his paintings. He went to prison. He caused many problems. I would hear that he had caused some little skirmish or uprising or something like that. He was a troublemaker in prison. And then probably 7 or 8 years ago, perhaps, he committed suicide. And I have very mixed feelings about that. Definitely, I think he was the kind of person who would take revenge, particularly if he thought that I had promised him that I would never tell anybody, that God loved him, I forgave him, and so forth. And I felt so guilty about the fact that I had turned him in, because I thought, what am I doing for the cause and the faith? And he would never become a convert because of what I did, because I turned out to be such a hypocrite. And that's, I still deal with that. It's still a struggle for me. And yet I think, as far as for society, he needed to be locked up. I'm sorry. As much as I'm very sorry he took his own life, I'm very much relieved, because I don't have to worry about the possibility of parole, because I really believe he would have come out and gotten me. When we were married, I made a decision. I did not want my maiden name at all in my new name, mm-hmm. because I was afraid he would look me up.
Thanks. Well, we've heard a lot of different perspectives here. And I think because it is 9 o'clock, I'd like to open it up to all of you, and then you can all feel free to respond to each other too. But maybe we can especially try to explore alternatives to prisons also as you know, possibilities. You mentioned electronic surveillance in homes, Al, and it seems like there are other possibilities. What do you think about what you're hearing from our panelists, or what are your responses? Or do you two want to respond here?
I'd like to say something.
Okay.
I don't think that prisons do anything to rehabilitate prisoners. I think that they are an alternative to the death penalty for people that are just too dangerous to be at large. And there are a certain percentage of people that I think are too dangerous to be at large. Probably your assailant will be, you know, one of them. But I think we're kidding ourselves if we think that prisons are going to rehabilitate anybody, and the setting itself is really contrary to that, to rehabilitate.
Somebody had a hand over here.
Yeah, I guess I would just add to the seeing crimes divided into violent and nonviolent. And I was robbed, my home was burglarized I guess 3 years ago now. And it was so traumatizing to my daughter that she would not go into any room without me with her. So her sense of her space being violated continued for months. And the person was caught and went to prison. But my frustration is I never had any face-to-face with that person. I mean, I would rather have some way that he was involved with the community or something that connected him back up. Turns out he has children about the age of my daughter, and I don't think he's ever had any sense of what he did to her. You know, he just got warehoused somewhere, and maybe he's come to some realizations about it, maybe not, but I felt very frustrated as a victim because I was shut away from this person. And so I wish that we divided crime into violent and nonviolent, kept the nonviolent people involved in the community in some highly structured manner, but connect them back up instead of make them, educating them into even more perverse behavior, which is what they're exposed to in the penal system.
Barb, could I make just a quick comment on that? There's four things that the Justice Fellowship arm of Prison Fellowship Ministry is trying to do. One is to give a victim standing in court. So in criminal cases, just like in civil or in tort cases, that you do have a standing in court, and both in the prosecution and in the sentencing. But the government has to play a part too, because it could be that there's too great vengeance involved in it. The second part of it is pushing for restitution, which really is what biblical justice operated in that way. The third one is to bring about community correction, so it happens within the community rather than sending them off to prison. And the fourth one is to work on victim-offender reconciliation. Mm-hmm. So those are the four things that we are trying to work on to get a change in this.
And Mark, you're going to do a session on some of those issues on Saturday, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, it sounds like that.
Let me also say, as I listen to this, I know you can't tell people don't feel bad about things. I'm glad you turned them in. And it is because I don't think the answer is to not turn them in. I think it's the punishment that we use at prison that isn't working, because you probably prevented other women from being raped. And if they, you know, you don't know on prevention who it was, but if you knew who it was, they'd be all here thanking you.
I really respect and admire the great thing the Prison Fellowship is doing in terms of trying to promote these alternatives, and I think it's crucial. I guess I would also like to see us, when we think about the problem of crime and prisons, to think about preventative measures as well. I mean, we want to stop the crime, stop the barbaric stuff that goes on both during crime and during prisons. And we are not going to totally stop it, but You know, why is it that the people who are being sentenced to our prisons are primarily poor or racial minorities? Can we look at what our society is doing to racial minorities and the poor? I mean, shouldn't we be looking at the things that are pushing our society to this kind of criminal behavior? Also, you know, just working on things like child abuse. If we can stop child abuse, we will stop a lot of crime. We have to see the larger connections, I think, as well, and try to prevent some of the crime from happening to start with.
Uh-huh.
Along those lines, preventing, I don't know exactly what the figures are, but there are a high number of people in prisons who are chemically dependent.
Right.
And there is, I think, very little done in terms of rehabilitation and chemical dependency for those people. And as far as I know, no one has found anything that works for chemical dependency except the 12-step program. And you know, 12-step program is real simple, and it's something that could be available to those people.
When you're dealing with different cultures, though, Peter Bell is a person in Minnesota who's developed that now for the minority, especially Afro-Americans, and he indicated that, and it does work. The 12-step program is right, but he has adjusted so that it's working with Afro-Americans.
Yeah, and I think that
that's okay. Al, what kind of freedom do we have, or what kind of possibilities of creativity do we exist within our system to generate novel ideas for dealing with those who have committed crimes? I remember recently when Milken was sentenced, there was lots of stuff written about that, and there was all kinds of suggestions as to what his punishment should be. I thought the best one was that he should work for $30,000 a year and give everything else to the poor. How do we generate those possibilities?
There is plenty of opportunity, and there are people that are working towards alternative ways of punishing people than prison. But at the same time, there's a strong movement that's been going on for some time to throw them in prison and throw the key away. And then you don't have to pay any attention to them. And as long as that is fostered, I think we're moving that in that direction. There's more people moving in that direction than there are towards alternative sentencing and systems at work. Because, you know, we could quickly move. When I talk about electronic surveillance and all these new ways of handling that seem to have much greater success and less cost, you know, we could move in that direction. But I think it's going to take people interesting themselves enough in that and joining up with those organizations who have made an effort to move in that direction.
What do you mean by more of these people? Who are these people? And
there are organizations now. For instance, if you were in any of the 14 states that Justice Fellowship presently is in, there is a lobbying effort with a person who's in charge of that and task forces who go to the legislature and have developed legislation and with specific legislation to be adopted. And
so actually what you're talking is state government.
State government, right.
Make the decisions. Pass
it through state government. And so in some ways, in your states, it would be to have the kind of community corrections that we have in Minnesota that's been operating, as an example.
How do we tap into Justice Fellowship? How do we find out what those
What, those programs?
Yeah, how do we know what states they operate in? How do we connect with them?
Guess you could write me a letter and I'd give it to you.
You have some of that.
I should have brought that material.
On your first tape, don't you have some of that information on the first session? Well, let me
I get some material too.
Be devil's advocate here too. Or Mark, now what would you say about opening to someone who's afraid of the violent criminal, either taking revenge or being attacked? I mean, how does that, what do you do then about that piece with your proposal? I realize it's in the Bible, but.
I think, you know, there are people who are seemingly through the experiences of their childhood or mental imbalances or whatever, just highly deranged people. And they do totally irrational things. And I don't know, you know, just what the very best way of dealing with them is, but obviously there are some people that we have to protect from others and from themselves even sometimes. I don't think that has to happen in a traditional prison like we have now. I think that fear of crime is something that is always going to be with us. And that we can lock up, we've got 1 million locked up now, we can lock up 2 million or 3 million or 4 million. And there's always going to be some reason to be afraid of crime, because the murders that will be committed tomorrow and the day after tomorrow and the day after that are all going to be done, and the rapes and the swindling and so forth, they're all going to be done by people who are loose right now. And, you know, it's going to happen. We are evil people. We are going to have to find a way of living with faith in a world in which crime happens. We have to try, I think, to try to find, to think creatively about what is it that's pushing people into such evil behavior and try to deal with that. But it's going to happen. And we're going to have to live with fear.
You're going to have to contain the violent person somehow. Is that what you're saying, Mark?
I don't think that all violent people are dangerous. Most the crime that is least often repeated is murder. But there are murderers who are irrational, deranged people. But most murders are committed by a friend or family member against someone that they should love. Those murders are not likely to be repeated. But the irrational person who's just shooting at people on the road or whatever, I mean, those are the kind of people that are the most dangerous. In that sense, because they'll go on and on. Most murder happens out of anger towards someone that you love.
So have you thought it through to the point of alternatives? I mean, have you kind of thought about what doesn't work? What do you think would be a good idea?
I'm not an expert on these things. I know that there are things that are being tried, kind of things that that Al was talking about, I haven't seen studies to know precisely what's the most effective. We haven't tried them very much. So, you know, more research probably needs to be done to find what is most effective in dealing with those very deranged people.
Okay, well, I want to hear about some of the issues in some of your communities. How this connects with your life, where you are, and issues that you face there. I mean, don't just view this as a panel of experts. You're all experts here tonight, okay? So, I mean, they are experts, but, you know, so are you. So I'd like to hear some connections with your places too. Lonnie?
I was wondering what the thinking is of the experts up there on the death penalty. I had heard that some say, yeah, we should have it because if death hurt, and others say, well, no, it doesn't work. I wonder what the opinion would be on that. I'm thinking of this Bundy who killed, I don't know how many people, they don't even know. He was executed in Florida. Should he have been?
Who wants to take that one?
I'll go first. I've come down in opposition to death penalty. Now, as I mentioned, some other groups, it was the toughest decision I had, but I found I always voted against the death penalty. For instance, it was proposed in Congress that we should have the death penalty for anybody who kills somebody hijacking an airplane. And the reason why I voted against it primarily was that if you know you're going to lose your life, why would you ever stop from killing everybody on an airplane if you're doing that sort of thing? I thought it would bring about more murder, more killing, if it was absolutely that they had to have the death penalty rather than go through a court case like that. The other thing is, it takes at least 8 years to go through that. And so people don't look at the death penalty as a deterrent. The only way, I mean, sure, you probably want to save some money so you don't have to keep them in prison all that time, or you just figure that is a worthless human being that you should get rid of, and that part. But as far as deterrence, if you just look at deterrence, the reason why you don't touch a stove after you did it the first time as a kid is because you got hurt right away. Right away. If it took 8 years before you felt the hurt of touching a stove, I suppose you'd be keep touching stoves from doing that. See, that's the reason why it doesn't work. It works an awful lot better in Singapore, because if you got 15 grams or more of drugs on you, in 2 weeks you're going to be dead by hanging. And so that's much more of a deterrent there. And I talk to people, and the reason why they lock their luggage is so nobody will stick drugs in their luggage when they go into Singapore, rather than they're afraid somebody's going to steal something. But in the due process and the protection of rights of people, you know, we can't have immediate killing of people in this country, because we built this whole thing for the fairness in our system. So those are our reasons why I have come down opposed to the death.
Well, I heard that it costs more for the government for the death penalty than life imprisonment.
I mean, these are all the appeals and everything? Mm-hmm. Like that probably is, but it's got to be some reason for doing it. And
do either of you want to speak on this?
And I'm not an expert. I guess as far as the death penalty, I don't think I could vote to take somebody's life. That's all.
You know, God chose a murderer to write most of our epistles. God chose a murderer to give the Ten Commandments to. God chose a murderer to write many of the Psalms, and a rapist. First murder committed, God went out of God's way to protect that murderer from retribution. I say, let's give the death sentence to all those that God has given up on. I don't think we'll find any.
Vivian.
Barb, this isn't a personal experience, but I'm wondering why is crime so prevalent in the States more so than in other countries? Why are we so high?
Because they're getting trained well. That's one reason.
They're getting trained well?
Yeah, yes. We send them to a college course in crime when they commit their first murder, meaning prison. And then they learn how to do it better. After that, more than half the people in prison have been in prison before. And so, see, that's why, you know, 74% of all the people in prison are rearrested again in 4 years. They don't all go to prison, but they're rearrested in 4 years. So, you know, we wouldn't do much of anything that's such a failure as that.
Somebody had a hand over here.
Have any other countries found a solution that is serving better than our failing system?
We have an expert.
No, I just want to say we have in West Germany, we tried to keep people who take drugs in special groups and they try together to get rid of drugs. They have many success with it, but we tried that with murder too, and the success was not very high. So just saying that the alternative with people who take drugs, keep them in special groups working on a farm, and they're responsible for animals or something like that. I don't know, but they like it and they like to work in teams of them.
I'd like to, Mark, what is the statistic of drug-related crimes to all crime? Would anybody have that on hand, a statistic? And whether or not legalization of drugs would be something that would, you or any of you would consider as being an appropriate response?
I think it would, the legalization of drugs would be very helpful.
Yeah.
I'm all against drugs.
Yeah.
I think we've got to have tremendous programs to get people off of drugs. But we're just creating crime the way it is now. I don't have any statistics about that,
okay.
And I just looked up at my wife, who's hiding up there, teaches criminology, and she shook her head. She doesn't know what offhand.
Oh, okay.
Really, Joan, you teach criminology? Do you have anything? Go ahead.
I want so that you know that Mark and I don't agree with everything. I don't agree with legalizing drugs. And we'll be able to watch Denmark and see how it goes with that. You know, we legalize alcohol. And when you look at all the things the deaths and the pain that's caused, alcohol causes much more than do drugs. And so, you know, legalize it, and then that can kill as many people as alcohol does. When you look at another legal drug is tobacco. You know, the people are just dying all over because of tobacco.
Okay, we got to have a different form on drugs. Good question, Paul.
Okay, yeah, right.
All right, let me just summarize here. Okay, we've got Al, who had said earlier he wants to let about half the people in prisons out right away.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we've got Mark, who wants to let everybody out right away. Okay, then we have Audrey, who is a victim and has seen the suffering that it's caused the person who committed the crime, but is also very aware of the fact that she's been hurt by this. And same thing with Dorothy and the fear component there too. All right, so now you've heard from our panel expert. We have 7 minutes left. I want to hear from some of you, okay? Not questions to the panel, but I want to hear what you think about these issues. We have people that disagree with each other up here. What are your views? Do you agree with any of them? Do you disagree? What do you think? Okay.
Well, fear is real, and you have a right to have fear. And a community has to have some system, much better than what we've got now, but you have to have some system of taking the people away who will very likely do the damage again. You can't let them all out free. We're very much in turmoil right now in Vancouver, Washington, because of a young man who has killed and mutilated little children. I mean, that just doesn't happen in Vancouver, Washington, but it did. The little bodies are found out by Vancouver Lake, and the young man is ill, he's sick. He needs to be put away someplace where he won't be out again. You can't have a society exist with that kind of fear for their children or for any other vulnerable kind of people. So we can't. I think to say you let all of the people out makes it very difficult, because then it turns people off from listening to good alternatives. People like I'm speaking of say, you can't. People like Dodd has to be put away forever. And so I like better to say we need better alternatives that will keep those people out, but let's do something for all those others in there that we can help. I don't think we can help a Dodd, but let's not lump them all in one bag.
Well, there, the people that would be opposed to letting somebody like that stay in jail forever are the ones that advocate capital punishment. And the people who advocate capital punishment would allow us to lock certain kinds of people up forever. We might be able to have a life sentence.
I think your statement about God points up some failings about other systems in our society. For example, I think we do need to pay more attention to our mental health system, so these people do have alternatives to go to, because that got cut a lot in the Reagan years. And I think it was one of the speakers we were talking about, prevention is where we really need to put our money in our education, that a lot of child abusers, a lot of children who were abused become abusers, and so we need to put some more money into those systems if we're going to make progress.
I really like the concept of restitution rather than punishment. Just as in rearing children, punishment is usually rather ineffective, even if it happens immediately. But natural or logical consequences that follow something has a much more lasting effect, and it enables the person to make conscious decisions based on what's likely going to happen next. And therefore, I really like the concept of restitution. And I know the mechanics are very difficult, but according to learning theory, I think that would be the best alternative to what we have now.
What does restitution mean if you're talking about murder or rape or something? I mean, how do you make restitution for that?
You don't make restitution. Am I not supposed to say?
No, go ahead.
We're talking about all
this. This is just off the top of my head, but and it's almost ludicrous to say it, but I'm going to say it anyway. And that is for a murderer to, in some way, conduct an apology to the family members who are involved in this, because of the tremendous loss that's experienced by the ones left behind. The one murdered, I would hope, is with the father, but those left behind are the ones that are in extreme pain. And I think an apology, if conducted appropriately, can do a lot to help in that grieving process. And it can also, I mean, that's the most logical kind of consequence for somebody who inflicts pain on others, is to express their feelings and their behavior.
Al, did you want to say something?
Yeah, restitution isn't in every case, but so many of them, it is property crimes, all things you have to make restitution for. But as I've read of her, people working on restitution feel, even on murder, that the families are suffering a great deal. And if the person then made restitution, you know, you get all kinds of medical expenses and all of that as well. But, you know, it isn't the answer to everything. But it sure is better than the system we have now.
It seems to me that, or one reflection I'd have is that Jesus forgave people who nailed him to a cross. That was pretty gruesome. That's just an example to me of the caliber of forgiveness we're called to conjure up as Christians.
Do either of you have a reaction to that?
I have a feeling as a victim, when I analyzed myself 17, 18 years ago, I have a feeling I had that some of the things that I did afterwards to sort of meet the defendant's attorney and get to know the policeman and those things. Those were sort of fulfilling a need I had to somehow resolve the conflict within me and to find out about this individual who had done this to me. I think it really, you know, I don't know that I could have faced him again, but I think there's probably a pretty strong need in a lot of people to kind of understand it for whatever reason. And given the fact that I did talked to him immediately after the event and saw the kind of response, I have a feeling it probably would be fairly effective to have the victim and the perpetrator meet. Not against anybody's will, but probably would work a lot of the time.
How about you, Audrey? How would you have felt about meeting the perpetrator again?
As far as with mine?
Yeah, would you have wanted reconciliation with her, or?
No, I don't think that that was, I guess I put it out of my mind as far as, I mean, we had lost, as far as that goes, but that's on an individual basis. And before we came in here, I was reading the paper, and it gets back to the political, but I was reading about Poindexter.
You're really hard to hear.
I know, I'm sorry. I said I was reading the paper before we came in here, and I was reading about Poindexter, and I don't know, there's so many different crimes. I think maybe we could back to our whole system that, what do you do? I mean, there's degrees of everything. Some are horrendous, and it's not actually at a person, it's at the whole, our whole system.
Okay, well, we're out of time, so it's perfect. Now we've got a big picture. Anyway, I just wanted to ask a question in ending. How many of you are, and I have to say I haven't, how many people in this room have ever visited someone in prison? Which Jesus commands us certainly to do. Okay, good for you. Well, great. Anyway, I was just curious, because I think, you know, that's certainly a first step, too. We're out of time. Obviously, we haven't resolved anything, but thank you so much, everyone, and hopefully the conversation can continue.